I'm Al Hunt, and I think you might guess this is James Carville. And this is my favorite city. I lived here for 2 years as a kid. I love Boston. And pretty soon, we will be elevated considerably when Doris Goodwin comes out here. But first, I want to ask you a question. And I want you to answer, you know, really be loud. How many of you are nervous about the Tuesday night election? Okay. All right. I'm going to calm you down a lot. James Carville is going to give you some news. Go ahead, James.
Thank you, Albert. I don't know how y'all say it here, Baston? Some kind of shit. So we were down in the green room or whatever it was. So I get a text. And by way of context, it is generally and correctly believed that the Iowa poll that Ann Seltzer does is the most accurate poll possible. In the state of Iowa, in the Des Moines Register, shows Harris beating Trump 47-44. About 2 or 3 weeks ago, I did an op-ed in the New York Times, said Harris is going to win, I'm certain. I just did that because I didn't want more people to commit suicide that were coming up to me. But,
and James, I'm certain now that Trump won Iowa by 8 points.
By eight. Won 10 in 16 and eight in 2020. And he's at 44. And there's a ironclad rule. If you're known by 100% of the people and you're at 44, you're in bad shape.
Do you feel better now? It was worth the price of admission?
Yeah.
Yay!
Yeah.
But James, you know, even before, this is startling news. I mean, it really is startling news. But even before this came in, you were really pretty confident that Kamala Harris was going to win.
Right. So I'll give you my reasoning. You know, I'll assign reasons. First of all, the Democratic coalition from Dick Cheney to AOC is all intact. No one is mad. No one, just say whatever you got to say. Just win the goddamn election. We'll deal with it when it's over. I was at the JFK school last night. Al and I were there, and I was talking to Nikki Haley's campaign manager. Nikki Haley got 250,000 votes in North Carolina 30 days after she dropped out. They're not happy in their coalition. The second thing, we have more money. Well, I don't know what it matters, but people spend a lot of time raising it. Third, we have, whatever it's worth, a ground game. Okay, we got troops deployed. We got somebody, I don't know if it's true or not, said that they estimate that the Harris campaign is and affiliates are knocking on 2,000 doors a minute in Pennsylvania. Every hotel in Philadelphia is full. In our hotel rooms, people are coming in to knock on doors and volunteer. I think the United States is going to have a good night Tuesday night. I really do.
And I would just add, this is the 14th presidential election that I have covered, written about. Please don't do the math. It was kind of a cliche where they'd always say this is the most important election of our lifetime. It wasn't. It wasn't 1860. It wasn't a few other elections, but it wasn't in 1988 or whatever. This is the most important election of any of your lifetimes. And it is not a cliche to say democracy and the rule of law are on the ballot. And in 2016, one of these smart young conservative writers wrote that the problem, she said, is that the press takes Trump literally and but not seriously, and the public takes him seriously but not literally. This year, take him seriously and take him literally. He has told you exactly what he's going to do. There is an enemy from within, and he is going after that enemy from within. He's even named a few people like Nancy Pelosi. So the stakes are enormous, and someone said, I want to turn this back to James, who has been out front on this for so long. I mean, as a very loyal Democrat and as someone who thinks that Joe Biden has been a very good president, he really began... He began saying over a year ago, the president should not run again. And it wasn't because of his record, which is really superior. It was because that Frank, it was age. We are close to Joe Biden's age. We know. And I think the decision was made belatedly, but the two people who play the biggest role in it happening were James Carville and Nancy Pelosi. And, that's a duo I'll stick with any time. Go ahead, James.
Well, thank you, Albert. And I'll just talk a little bit. I saw a poll, with, actually it's in the document. It happened to be there. It was an ABC poll in May of 2023. And I left that poll and said, we can't win. It's not going to change. And if I have one lesson to take from the Biden administration, great record. Build back better. The economy is really good. Inflation is down. But the two things, there's something that you got to understand Americans don't like, and that's disorder. Now, the original border policy, he listened to these left wingers. It was a giant mistake, as everything that they say is a giant mistake. And it looked like disorder. People watching it on TV. And one that people, it didn't look like orderly. Okay, I think the best decision he ever made was just getting out of Afghanistan. Just we'll even go out. But it looked disorderly. And people don't like disorder. They don't dislike migrants, all right? They don't like stupid wars. But there's a, just understand that, there's a reflexive reflex that people have about disorder. They don't like it. And that, you know, when you have, it looks like there's crime, but there's no order, and you walk around the streets, and that correctly makes people nervous. We feel like that we pay a lot of taxes, we all good citizens, we don't mind that, but the deal we make is we have order in our lives. And always, always, always watch out for that, because that, and I think Harris has done a good job. But in terms of Biden, so I'm 80. Right, I know what old age is. Yeah, you're goddamn right.
You know, you really don't, because I'm 81.
Right. And I have some idea of what the job of president is. And it's just incompatible. I don't care who you are. And I had a platform, so I just didn't feel like I could just sit there and say nothing. And it has nothing to do with, I think Joe Biden done so many good things. He's actually a person I really admire. He's like a state school guy. He stuttered. He overcame that. He's had every kind of family tragedy you can. He's led a real life. He's a real human. He's a decent man. But he's too old. And it's just that simple. And it's not... You never can get past the original evaluation. And people would call me and say, James, you know, Joe's a great guy. I said, I know he's a great guy. He's too old. And you're not going to change that. But anyway.
All right, I've got three things. One, if any of you have not seen the documentary on James, you ought to see it right now. It achieves the impossible. It captures him. The second thing is to tell you that after, you know, we're going to have some fascinating conversation ahead, and there'll be time for audience questions on that side, the left and the right. I'll try to move as equally to my right as I do to my left. So think about questions and come up. And thirdly, would anyone here like us to bring out Doris Goodwin? I think we can arrange that.
What a night this will be.
I think this is a home crowd.
But we're all home here together.
Doris has, is one of the greatest historians in the history of the world. And every book is fascinating. Her latest book on travels and life and love with her husband, Dick Goodwin, is just so special. Let me start off by asking you, though, we're in a really extraordinary time in American politics. Doris, have we ever seen anything like this? Have we ever seen anything like Trump and like the threat that some people think that he poses?
I'm not sure we've ever seen anything like a candidate for president like Trump, but we have seen other times when democracy's in peril. This is why history is so helpful. We can know that we've gone through those times and somehow managed to emerge from them. I mean, just think what it was like for Lincoln in 1861. What he said as he faced those first 3 months of the beginning of the Civil War was that if he'd ever known what he was going to face, he would not have thought he could have lived through it. And he said democracy was on trial then, because if the southern states could decide they were going to break up the Union simply because they lost the election, then democracy would be an absurdity. There's a familiarity in that, right? And then you go to the turn of the 20th century, and Teddy Roosevelt warned that the country was so splintered up because of the Industrial Revolution. There was a big gap between the rich and the poor. There was a sense of a lot of immigrants coming in from abroad. There was nativism. There were people that were afraid of the new inventions that wanted, the automobile and the telephone and the telegraph. They wanted an earlier, more nostalgic way of life. People in the country hated the people in the city. And Teddy Roosevelt warned that when you get to a point where people in different sections, regions, or parties begin to think of each other as the other, then that's when democracy will be in peril. So it was then, too. And then you get to the early days of the Depression, and FDR was told as he was about to give his first inaugural, if you have a program that works, you'll be one of the great presidents in history. But if you fail, you'll be one of the worst. No, he said soberly, I'll be the last. So there was that feeling then that democracy was absolutely, and that's when Mussolini and Hitler come on the world stage. And then you have the early days of 1940 when Hitler goes his blitzkrieg across Western Europe, leaving only France standing alone. America's only 18th in military power with hardly anything to be able to help anybody. We only become 17th when Holland surrenders. We let our whole establishment go. We had only 500 fighter planes. And if Hitler had prevailed, not only democracy, but Western civilization would have been at risk. So each one of those times, somehow, the people living then didn't know how it was going to end. That's why they were so anxious, just like we're so anxious. But history has shown us we've come through it before, and it takes a few things to get through it again, but I think we will get through this.
Doris, elaborate a little bit more on what might get us through this.
Well, here's where history tells us, I think, what are the qualities of the leader you need to get us through this complicated time? And just think about who might have these qualities of character without mentioning even a name. When Lincoln comes in, the most important thing he has right at the start is humility. He knows that he's not all important, that he doesn't know enough to be able to be the leader that he wants to be. He needs to surround himself with people who were better educated, more celebrated, each one of whom wanted to be president instead of him. And he creates the famous Seward, Chase, and Bates, puts them into the top of his cabinet. And that was the critical decision that he made the night that he won the election, that he knew he had to surround himself with these people. Now, Lyndon Johnson would have put that notion, because his friend said, you'll be a figurehead. You can't do that. You'll not look powerful enough. He said, the country is in peril. These are the strongest and most able people in the country. I need them by my side. But Lyndon Johnson would have put it in less noble language. He liked to say, it's better to have your enemies inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in. So that's the first thing. losing by surrounding himself with these people who could argue with him. He had all the factions in the North right there, those who wanted emancipation immediately, those who didn't want it at all, those who just wanted something in the middle. And then he could figure out the timing of when to give the Emancipation Proclamation. And then the other major quality he had was empathy and magnanimity. I mean, think about the time in the spring of 1865, the war is coming to an end, the Union's going to win. No retribution does he want. On the contrary, he says, I don't want the Confederate soldiers executed, as some people did. I don't want punishment. I want us to move forward. And then the second inaugural, we cannot possibly imagine to hear from one of our candidates when he says, neither side anticipated this war, neither knew how long it would be. Both sides read the same Bible. Both prayed to the same God. Neither's prayers were fully answered. With malice toward none and charity for all, let us bind up the nation's wounds. That is what we need right now. So that's him, right? Yeah. And then think of Teddy Roosevelt at that turn of the 20th century. He came in with a lot of charisma. He had charisma. He could really use that power among people. And at first, he had a swelled head about it. When he first got to the state legislature, he wanted to be the center of attention so much that people said he wanted to be the baby at the baptism, the bride at the wedding, and the corpse at the funeral. But he finally realized that he was becoming a pain in the ass. He kept popping up and down, speaking so often, calling his Democratic opponents by such terrible names that people said he couldn't get anything done. And his own Republican friends told him, you've got to change yourself. And he realized he'd gotten a swelled head. So he changed his rhetoric and he became a productive legislator. But then most importantly, he understood all the different parts of the country. He was curious. He'd lived in the West. He'd lived in the East. He'd been in Eastern duty. He'd been a cowboy. He was a rough rider. He'd been a soldier. He'd been a police commissioner. He'd been a civil service commissioner. So when the time came to knit that country together, he had the perfect slogan, a square deal for the rich and the poor, the capitalist and the laborer, and that got us through. And then FDR comes in at the terrible time of the Depression with one out of four people out of work and starving people wandering the streets. The financial system has collapsed. And he has the confidence and the optimism in believing in America. I think one of the things you said, James, in your thing was that a politics of hope is always going to beat a politics of dread. And here he was, the country was in a terrible state of anxiety. He gives that first inaugural address, and he starts off, only a foolish optimist would deny the brutal realities of the moment. And then he does the famous phrase, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. But most importantly, what he said to the people, it wasn't your fault. People thought it was their fault. Men used to go out in their suits in the day, pretending they were going to work and come home at night, so humiliated that they'd lost their jobs. He said, it's not your fault. It's leadership that has failed, and I'm here to provide that leadership. And I will go to Congress, and I will get jobs for you, and if that doesn't work, I will act as if I'm a president at war. We will get this done. It was so effective. The mood of the country changed overnight. There were headlines, we have a leader, somebody's taking responsibility, they're going to help us, we have a government. And then hundreds of thousands of letters came into the White House saying, one of my favorites said, my roof fell off, my dog ran away, my wife is mad at me and I've lost my job, but now everything's all right because you are there. And then most importantly, he had his own team of rivals in Eleanor Roosevelt. Oh, I wish Eleanor were alive today. She would be so happy with what's going on right now. But I mean, she was always able. She was a welcome thorn in his side, always willing to argue with him, always willing to question his assumptions. And she was the one who had a female only press conferences so that only female reporters could come every week. So an entire generation of journalists got their start because of Eleanor Roosevelt's press conferences. She sent so many memos to General Marshall about discrimination in the Army that he had to appoint a separate general whose only task was to deal with Eleanor Roosevelt. So having that, she was the one who argued women had to go to work in the factories even before Pearl Harbor. The old stuffy factory owners said, oh, they'll never learn to operate these complex heavy machines. They'll distract the men on the assembly line. Productivity will go down. And so they wouldn't bring them on until finally after Pearl Harbor. They did. And when women formed 60% of the job force in the airplane factories and the shipyards, productivity went up rather than down. So this is women are going to save this thing. Women are out there. So I love what, I mean, more women are voting right now, they've shown already. Women are registered to vote. Women, abortion is a huge issue, but it's women wanting the rights for their own selves that is on the line right now. And Eleanor understood that. So anyway, to make a more humorous note to it, what happened is these same old factory owners decided we better do a study, figure out how these women learned to operate these complex machines so well and so quickly. I love the answer that came back on one of the study forms. They said, oh, it's simple. When a woman, unlike a man, was asked to operate a new piece of machinery, she would ask directions. Any of us who used to travel with you know what that means. At any rate, and then lastly, in World War II, even before Pearl Harbor for 18 months, Roosevelt recognized that he had to bring in top Republicans in order to perform some sort of unity. He brings in Stimson and Knox, two top Republicans. He brings in two top production people, Chrysler CEO and Sears, to run his production agencies, and they get that assembly line moving with business and government working hand in hand before 18 months before Pearl Harbor, and by 1942 we were able to produce a plane every 4 minutes, a tank every 7 minutes, and a ship was launched every single day. And that's what we can do if we work together, and that's what we got to have happen after this.
Wow. James, follow up with some of that with Doris.
So, Doris, you know a lot of history, particularly know about two people, Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt. They obviously were different eras, different people, different regionally, different everything about them. What did they have in common? Is there something that we can kind of learn from Lincoln and Roosevelt, that they, some qualities that they shared, because they were obviously stunning leaders?
I think that what they had in common was not simply what they did, but who they were. And what that all has to do with is those qualities like humility and empathy and resilience and accountability and ambition for something larger than oneself, telling the truth and communicating with the country. And, you know, it all comes down. Lincoln always, we were talking about this in the green room, Lincoln always wanted to be remembered after he died. He somehow became obsessed with the thought when his mother died when he was only 9 years old, and she said to him, Abraham, I'm going away from you now, and I shall never return. And then he became, what happens to us after we die? The first time he ran for office, he said, every man has his peculiar ambition. Mine is to accomplish something worthy so I might be remembered after I died. He just had a feeling that's the only way you could be remembered. And boy, as you were saying when we were talking about this, he got his wish when he signed the Emancipation Proclamation. But even Lincoln could never have imagined how far his reputation would reach. And this answers your question in a way. Leo Tolstoy told a story that I was able to end Team of Rivals with, which was the perfect ending because I never want my guys to die. And he said that he had just come back from a remote area of the Caucasus where there are a group of wild barbarians. They'd never left that part of Russia. They were so excited to have him in their midst that they asked him to tell stories of the great men of history. So I told them about Napoleon and Alexander the Great and Frederick the Great and Julius Caesar, and they seemed to love it. But then the chief stood up and he said, but wait, you haven't told us about the greatest ruler of them all. We want to hear about that man who spoke with the voice of thunder, who laughed like the sunrise, who came from that place called America that is so far from here that if a young man should travel there, he'd be an old man when he arrived. Tell us of that man. Tell us of Abraham Lincoln. Tolstoy was stunned to know Lincoln's name had reached this part, but then the reporter said to him, okay, so what made Lincoln so great after all? And he said, well, he wasn't as great a general as Napoleon, not as great a statesman as Frederick the Great, but his greatness consisted in his character, the ultimate standard for judging our leaders. And when people say character doesn't matter in this election, what matters is whether we're going to have a tax cut, what matters is inflation, they are dead wrong. Both those men had character, and that's what they had in common.
Sir. Thank you. There have been various definitions of history. I think Napoleon said, what is history but an agreed-upon fable? And Henry Ford's definition of history was, it's just one fucking thing after another. Which, that's kind of... But how... So you were graduated, you know, you started your career, you've now been a historian. What have you learned about history? What are we learning? What's the state of history, historiography? What's some groundbreaking stuff that we're learning about that I didn't know, you didn't know, other people didn't know when they were in college?
Well, I think one of the things about history that's worrisome today to me is that there are alternative narratives of history right now. Alternative narratives of the past, alternative narratives of what's happening right now. I mean, if I get nervous about our country, it is really that. I mean, I think about the 1850s when Charles Sumner was attacked in the Capitol by Preston Brooks, a South Carolina congressman, over the head, hit with a cane, unconscious, carried out, not back to the Senate for 3 years. He became a hero, rightly, in the North. It helped to mobilize people for the Republican Party, the young Republican Party. But the worrisome thing was, in the South, that same event was interpreted entirely differently. Preston Brooks became a hero, and all of a sudden everybody's carrying around canes, and they're saying, well, we better go after Seward, Chase, and Bates, and all these other people as well. I mean, that's exactly what's happening today. You have an alternative narrative of what went on in Springfield, Ohio, when people are claiming that migrants were responsible for eating cats and dogs, and people believe that. And even when the governor of Ohio and the mayor of Springfield say that it's not true, that fact that's not true is being believed. And we have history that's being diminishing in our colleges right now, in our high schools, and people not knowing civics. We have to get, I mean, that's why I love history so much. It's so important. It gives us solace and perspective and truth about the past. It's all complicated. I mean, Churchill said, I'm going to do well in history because I'm going to write it. So I think there's something to that. Whoever writes the history gets to do it. But right now, people are writing false statements of what America was about. They're afraid to, some teachers have talked about the fact they're afraid to even teach Jim Crow because you're not supposed to be teaching things that make people feel guilty. We shouldn't be teaching about slavery. This is crazy. We have enormous strengths in this country, and we're strong enough to be able to abide by the fact that a lot of times things were not right. Things weren't wrong. One didn't go well. We were caught in the context of the time. But those acts are what made us so great. Birmingham and Selma, there were terrible things that happened. We were talking earlier about Bull Connor. But out of those came the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65.
So before I turn it back to Al, we were at the JFK school last night. And this is something. And Boston is a center of intellectual power. There's no doubt about that. New York is a center of financial power, marketing power. Hollywood is a center of cultural power. But I told the students, agree, the most important power in the world is political power. Political power can affect more lives more directly than any other kind of power. And it drives me crazy when people say, oh, I don't want to fool with politics. I don't want to get in the middle of that. Well, if you don't get in the middle of it, it's going to get in the middle of your life, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the most important thing that I worry about, too, is that you want young people to feel like they want to go into public life. I mean, there's certain periods in history when public life seems more exciting for people. It was true at the turn of the 20th century. It was true, in the 1930s. It was true in the 1960s. That's why I loved living in the 1960s when I was working on this last book, because there was a feeling that people had. It's not just the power that you want to reach in Washington. It's the power you want to feel in yourselves. I mean, what happened in the 1960s was that individuals felt they could make a difference. So they joined the Peace Corps. Tens of thousands marched against segregation with Martin Luther King and John Lewis in freedom rides and sit-ins. They really had the belief that they could change things. And by God, they did. And we have to get that feeling back in young people again, because they haven't seen that. They haven't seen that. And maybe they'll be out there voting this. You know, when you talk about the fact that former President Trump has talked about vengeance, the best vengeance we can have right now is to get to those polls and make sure that everybody we know gets to those polls.
Doris, let's talk about that book. I told her that it was one of the most extraordinary books I've read recently, at least, and I had a different experience because I read half of it and I listened to half of it, and I couldn't quite decide which I liked better. I think listening, because she was so good in describing it. But tell us about the book, but tell us about your extraordinary husband, the late Dick Goodwin, and the central role, more than anyone outside of a president, that he played in the 60s.
You know, well, what happened, luckily, was that he was a pack rack, and he had kept everything from the 1960s. 300 boxes schlepped around with us our whole married life. They were in cellars, they were in attics, and he wouldn't open them because the 60s had ended so sadly. I mean, he was like, as James was saying earlier, he was like Zelig in the 60s. He's everywhere you want him to be. He's in the John Kennedy campaign when he's in his 20s. He's on the White House staff with JFK. Then he's with LBJ and all the great civil rights speeches that he works on. And then he leaves him and turns against the war, and he's with Senator Eugene McCarthy in New Hampshire. And then Bobby enters the race, who was his closest friend, and he's with Bobby in the campaign and when he dies. And the all these 300 boxes had everything in them. They had journals and diaries and menus and speech drafts and newspaper clippings. And I'd known what was in them, but he wouldn't open them because this decade had ended so badly that he just felt too sad with Bobby's death and Martin Luther King and the riots in the streets, etc. Finally, he turns 80 and comes down the steps singing one day, "Oh, what a beautiful morning." And I said, "What's up?" And he said, "It's now or never," going into Elvis now. And he said, "I've decided it's time to open the boxes. If I have any wisdom to dispense, I better start dispensing now." That's the way he talked. So we made a pact that every weekend we would go through the boxes, but we would do them chronologically and suspend knowledge of what was going to come later. So the sadness of JFK dying in 63 wouldn't shadow what happened in 60 and 61 and 2, et cetera, et cetera. The Vietnam War would not shadow what happened in 64 and 65. And it was the last great adventure of our life, really. I mean, it gave Dick, who had came away from that decade with an underlying melancholy that never quite left him. All of us who knew that saw him there. And it had to do with his feeling that it had failed. He was wrong. The Great Society had not failed, but he felt that it had because the war had obviously cut so much of it in two. And when we went through the boxes, suddenly he began to remember what it was like to feel that sense of making a change. And I remember one night after we'd gone through the boxes in 64 and 65, where he was so involved in the naming of the Great Society and working on that in the great We Shall Overcome speech. And we went upstairs and he couldn't go to sleep. And he said, "Oh my God, I'm feeling affection for the old LBJ again." And that was really important because we'd fought about this all my life. I was an LBJ girl and he was a JFK boy. But anyway, more importantly, he came to terms with the fact that maybe it had made a difference what he'd done. And he made a hell of a difference in the 1960s. Words mattered in those days.
He did make a hell of a difference on so many issues. You mentioned civil rights and the Great Society, but also in the arts and Latin America. And what was fascinating, the whole thing was fascinating, but you all did not know each other then, but you went and during Johnson's last year, you were a White House fellow and worked for the president, even though you had called for him to be defeated in the election, and then went to work part-time for him to help with his memoirs. So he was a Kennedy person, and you were a Johnson person, and you relate some of the tension. I mean, he did go up that one night, as you say, and said, "I'm starting to like the old guy." But there were differences that you had. There were times that you thought that the Kennedys, for instance, had been insensitive, and there were times that he thought that that your view of Johnson was too favorable. And that it wasn't tension so much as it was just this wonderful historical exchange.
Yeah, I mean, I understood as we went through the boxes even more than maybe in my memory how inspiring Kennedy could be and was. I just always would say to my husband, "Yeah, but he would never have gotten those programs through that LBJ did get through," and I think that's probably true. I mean, I just felt a loyalty to Johnson. I mean, you're right, I had been against him. What had happened is when I was chosen as a White House fellow, we had a big dance at the White House the night we were selected, and President Johnson did dance with me, but it wasn't peculiar. There were only three women out of the 16 White House fellows. But as he danced, he whispered he wanted me to be assigned directly to him in the White House. But it turned out that I had been involved earlier, as so many young people had, while I was a graduate student at Harvard at the time when I was chosen in the anti-war movement. And I'd written an article with a friend against Lyndon Johnson and against the war, which we'd sent to the New Republic but heard nothing until 2 days after the dance. It just suddenly miraculously appeared with the title, "How to Remove Lyndon Johnson in 1968. So I was certain he would kick me out, but surprisingly, he just said, "Bring her down here for a year, and if I can't win her over, no one can." So mostly, then I went to work on the memoirs with him, and mostly he just wanted to talk. He wanted to talk to me, maybe because I was an historian. He would talk about what it was like when he was in the National Youth Administration, when he brought rural electricity to the Hill Country. And luckily, my two chapters, I was working with a small team on the memoirs, were on civil rights in Congress, so that's what he was happy talking about. And I thought that was why he was talking to me, and maybe he was talking to me because I listened well. And then I also worried part of it was that I was then a young woman, and he had somewhat of a reputation. So I was constantly chattering to him about steady boyfriends, even when I had none at all. And it all worked perfectly until one day he said he wanted to discuss our relationship, which sounded ominous, especially when he took me to the Lake LBJ, wine and cheese and a red check tablecloth, all the romantic trappings that he started out. "Doris, more than any other woman I have ever known," and my heart sank. And then he said, "You remind me of my mother." So anyway, I will be forever grateful to him because those conversations with him became the first book. And then all of a sudden, I become a presidential historian. Lincoln and Teddy and Franklin Roosevelt, and 50 years have gone by, and I've been studying dead presidents. It may seem an odd profession, but I wouldn't change it for anything. I chose the ones I wanted to live with.
Doris, do you think Lyndon Johnson's standing with historians and his reputation is changing, is being, I hate to use the word rehabilitated, but you know what I mean?
No, without a question. I mean, he's come up. I mean, the war in Vietnam will always be his handling of the war, a scar on his legacy. But I think people have realized after the fact what happened domestically, Medicare, Medicaid, aid to education, civil rights, voting rights, affirmative action, NPR, PBS, National Foundation of the Arts. It's extraordinary. There's nothing like it since the New Deal. And the historians, in some recent polls, he was 12 and 11. There was a recent poll I saw that he was 8 and JFK was 9. Oh, boy, would that make him happy. This is one of the unusual presidents, whereas FDR, for example, was great both domestically and in foreign policy. For Johnson, foreign policy was something he wasn't ever comfortable with. He never had a vision for what success would be in Vietnam. He was just worried about failure, and he kept moving along and not wanting to fail, and that's no way. But in American domestic policy, he knew from the first night he was there, he knew what he wanted to have happen. In fact, one of my favorite stories that Dick had told me was that after he had gone to work for Johnson about a month later, it's in the spring of 1964, and it's only a few months from JFK's death, Bill Moyers comes to Dick and says that he wants us to talk about a Johnson program. He wants there to be something that's his agenda. He's got the tax cut through. Now the civil rights bill is getting through. And so Dick said, are we meeting him in the Oval Office? He said, no, we're going to meet him in the White House pool. They go to the pool, and there is Johnson swimming stark naked up and down the pool. Dick said he looked like a whale. And then there's Dick and Moyers there with their suit and ties on. He said, well, come on, guys, come in. We have a lot to talk about. So they have no choice but to strip as well. So there's three naked guys swimming in the pool. And Johnson starts talking about what he wants to be, what his program. And so it's all out there. And they decide they'll have a speech on May 22nd at the University of Michigan, which gives a deadline. Speeches sometimes give a deadline for getting the programs developed. And then all those programs get developed. He gives the speech. And then he needs a name for this thing. And so they try out. Maybe it'll be a better deal rather than a new deal. But finally, Dick tries out in a few small speeches the Great Society, just in non-capital letters, but eventually it becomes the Great Society. So Dick liked to say, so the Great Society was born in a pool with three naked guys swimming around. But what a time to be there with the Great Society, and then the year later with Selma and the We Shall Overcome speech. So little wonder that Dick got some solace in remembering those wonderful times.
I want people to start thinking about asking questions. We're going to be talking a lot more about politics. But Doris, what would Lyndon Johnson have thought about today and politics today and about Donald Trump?
I'd love to see those two hand in hand. I mean, Lyndon Johnson could give a treatment to anybody, but I think the saddest thing he would feel is that voting rights have been diminished since 1965. That act that was passed in 65 really, for the first time, African Americans since that small period of time and after Reconstruction got what they should have gotten, which was that all those devices that were being used in the South to prevent them from registering, you had to answer what was the 13th Amendment, the 18th Amendment, how many jelly beans are there in a jar, things that would be prevented from ever asking. And after Selma, when the firing of the conscience had happened in the nation, and LBJ gave the speech to the joint session of Congress calling for a Voting Rights Act, he knew that was the most important. He said that voting rights is more important than any other right because everything else is underneath that. And to have seen what happened in the Supreme Court decision, to see what's happening now with suppression, to see that lack of a peaceful transition of power, he would be out fighting every moment of the day. And if the people do, as I say, go with a vengeance to the polls, which it seems to be that they're already doing, I think he'll be very happy to see that because he would trust that that's the way things will work.
James, you have been... You have been very forthright about why this Supreme Court should be on the ballot this year and what it has done.
Well, first of all, as our dear friend Walter Dellinger pointed out, that Mitch McConnell automatically changed the composition of the Supreme Court from 9 to 8. He just took it on his own. Right. And it's just, if somebody does some research and goes, how many of these people go before Congress and they said, what's your opinion on Roe v. Wade? And they go, well, I never thought about that. I'd have to read the briefs. Are you shitting me? Like, you went to Harvard Law School and you're 48 years old and you never thought about it? I don't know. It was the kind of problem here and somebody came up. I'll have to do my homework and study up and I'll read the briefs and see what I think. Or, you know, I believe in precedent. Okay. They lie. And so here we are in a country where we want to cream a third grader for not telling the truth, or you kick somebody out of college for looking over somebody's shoulder at an exam, and the Supreme Court is lying through just right in front of you, right in your face, and no one says anything. So Doris, watching Ken Burns baseball, and you were great. You were talking about you were a little girl growing up in Brooklyn, I think it was, and you know, you were, you know, kind of vivacious, feisty female growing up in not the most enlightened time in the world at that attitude. So what made you so fascinated with history? What made you just say, hey, I'm a little girl in Brooklyn, I'm a girl and I'm gonna take on all these great topics and the hell with it? What was your moment of something that just motivated you to just love history and want to read about it and learn about it?
Well, I think I really did love it from the time I was a little girl. In fact, I think because my father did teach me that mysterious art of keeping score while listening to the baseball games so I could record for him the history of that afternoon's Brooklyn Dodger game, it made me think there's something magic about history to keep my father's attention. He never told me that all of this was actually in the sports pages of the newspapers the next day. So I thought without me, he wouldn't even know what happened to the Brooklyn Dodgers. But I think also, as so often happened, I had a teacher in high school. Teachers can make all the difference in the world. And she won an award. This is why our public education system has got to get better salaries for our teachers. We need them there at every level along the way. And Miss Austin won an award as one of the best teachers in New York State. And she knew the people she was teaching us about with such detail that she made them come to life for us. I really felt they were there. In fact, when she told us about Lincoln dying, she actually cried. And I thought, she must have known him because she's crying. So that was pretty special. And I think that's what made me love history. It just made me feel you could bring dead people back to life. And maybe because my mother died when I was 15, my father died when I was in my 20s, that I wanted to tell their stories. So I finally wrote about them in terms of loving baseball. And my mother had had rheumatic fever as a child, so she was an invalid during my childhood. But she read books in every spare moment she could find. She had a series of heart attacks when I was young. And every night she would read to me. The only thing that I loved more than her reading stories to me was telling me stories about her when she was a little girl. I somehow became obsessed with the idea if she could, her mind would control her body if she started remembering when she could skate or when she could go up the stairs two at a time. So I constantly say to her, Mom, tell me a story about you when you were my age, not realizing how peculiar that was until my own three sons have never once said to me, Mom, tell us a story about you when you're our age. But I think it was storytelling that attracted me. I think of myself more as a storyteller, and that's what history is. It's stories of people who lived before, and everybody should love it because it's about drama and conflict. It's not about boring dates and all. If you care about the people, you'll care about when they lived and when they died because it matters who does what when. So I just wish everybody, if I could inject everybody with a love of history, I think we'd be far better off in this country.
So let me find out, I have one question. Let me just find out, James. We have people coming up on the left and right.
Did you score nobody a swing there? And strike out with a backwards K?
I certainly did.
Okay. And a call third strike was a front K, right?
Exactly. You got it. Anyway, you knew it. I knew I loved you.
Okay, go ahead.
And did you forgive the Dodgers for moving to Los Angeles?
Oh, my God. No, I wrote so many letters to Walter O'Malley and the owner of the Dodgers. The terrible thing we used to say in New York was that what if you were in, this is so bad as an historian, what if you were in a room with Hitler and Stalin and Walter O'Malley, and what if you had only two bullets? What would you do? And the terrible answer was we'd have to shoot O'Malley to make sure we kept the Dodgers in Brooklyn.
As people were coming up, I just want to say one thing I forgot. We had a fascinating conversation beforehand with our mutual friend Tommy Vallely, who was a great hero, a Marine combat veteran in Vietnam, who made the fascinating point, I thought, Doris, that the difference between Johnson and Nixon in Vietnam is that Nixon was cynical. Johnson just was lost.
I think that's right. You listen to the tapes, and it, early on, he's saying, I'm not sure why we're over there. But then once he started committing people, he felt too afraid of losing and failing. And it was just that he was lost and not knowing what to do. But it wasn't that, there's a difference between those two, even in Vietnam, very much so.
Yeah, I see people there. Please tell us your name before you ask your question.
Where we're from.
Oh, I can hear that voice.
I can hear that voice. I'm Brenda. I'm from Tennessee. I've been listening.
Where about in Tennessee, girl?
I met you on the street. At the convention. I'm from south of Nashville, from Pulaski, Tennessee.
Okay. Middle Tennessee.
Yes. My question is, and we've been talking about this a long time, about Trump being in jail. So when Kamala wins, do you think she needs to replace Merrick Garland?
Yes.
Wait a minute. And tell us why.
Well, first of all, 4 years is a long time to be Attorney General. Secondly, there's going to be a lot that's going to be. Remember, he's going to get sentenced on November 17th in New York, and the judge is not going to change that. And then these trials are going to come up. And, you know, I think, I have my own opinions of Merrick Garland, you know, but I think we need a new attorney general and say, I'll put some fresh eyes on this, and we're going to continue this. And, front person. It could be a she, he, there's 50 people in the United States that could be attorney general and be eminently qualified to do it. And we need somebody that project confidence because Trump is going. He knows it. He knows what he's faced with. And he's a scared, fat, pathetic sack of shit old man.
I promise you, before the evening's over, I'm going to get James to tell us what he really thinks. I can go to my right, so we have somebody over there.
Hi, my name is Lynn. I'm Kaufman. I'm from originally New Mexico, and we moved up here about 10 years ago, and we live in New Hampshire. So our voting day is on Tuesday. Anyway, my question to you is, everything Trump has said slides right off of him. It means nothing. However, last week, he was at one of his little rallies that he has. He didn't say it. A comedian that nobody has ever heard of made the comment about Puerto Ricans. That seems to have stuck. And I just wondered, if Trump had said it, do you think it would have stuck? Or do you think it would have rolled right off like everything else?
You know, we were talking about this again in the green room. I think something's happened in the last 10 days. And it started maybe with the enemies within, that Trump was claiming that we had enemies within. Nancy Pelosi and speakers needed to be possibly taken away. And then he talked about executing. We reprised the execution of Mark Milley, and then just recently the idea that Liz Cheney should be put up and 9 rifles put in her face. The combination of all that, and then what people said at that Madison Square Garden, I think it's had an impact. If there's a directional shift, as there seems to be right now, you made a really interesting point in the green room, Al, which was saying that in 1980 things were absolutely tied between Carter and Reagan. And then something happened in the last days before the election that people began to remember that, do we really want to have another 4 years of Carter? Things had been tough. And they decided to know they were going to take a chance with Reagan. And right now, it seemed before this that people were feeling a sense of, I don't know whether we want another 4 years of Biden, but now it seems like they're remembering what those years were like with Trump because of everything he said in these last few days. And it's possible that, I mean, maybe tonight, when you read us that Iowa poll, it's possible that history might suggest that this could be even bigger than we're hoping it could be, that maybe there will be a large amount of people coming to the polls and deciding that they don't want the same thing to be happening again and again and again.
You know, James has better political instincts than anyone I've ever known, and we know a fair amount about politics. We aren't quite as culturally informed as we should be. So after the Madison Square Garden things, a friend of mine in Pennsylvania called and said, "Well, I've got some great news for the, you know, for the Puerto Rican vote." I said, "What's that?" He said, "We got Bad Bunny." And I thought there was some kind of an animal outbreak in Pennsylvania till I learned that Bad Bunny is a really, really important Puerto Rican entertainer who makes a big difference and is going all out in Pennsylvania, which has like 275,000 Puerto Rican voters. So, wow. You know, hopefully that among with the things that Doris talked about.
So
you think I was unfair to
no,
say
I
you
think
were culturally
exactly
deprived?
Right. It's something we call in politics, something is sticky. It means it sticks, that people remember. The stickiest thing said in this entire campaign was J.D. Vance's Childish Cat Ladies. Everybody knew that.
Right.
Everybody heard it. Everybody knew what he was saying. No further explanation needed. We'll remember some of the language that was used or some of that, but people, and once he said, and we're looking, you know, we're going to see a very robust female turnout in this election. Of that, I'm
and the early voting in most states has been 55-56% female.
Right.
Which it wasn't last time.
No, it could balance, but stickiness, and let me tell you, Shakespeare was right. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And they're going to find out just how much fury Alito and Thomas and Emma and go, holy shit, what did we start here? You're about to find out, because let me tell you, people come up to me all the time and say stuff, I think every huge number of women in the United States, I'm going to tell these sons of bitches exactly what I think of them, and I think they're getting ready to do it. I really do.
Over there.
Great. My name is Paul Garrity, and first of all, thank you very, very much for being here tonight and for giving us a real sense of hope. My own hope and prayer is that we're going to see a blue wave on Tuesday. That's what I hope happens.
We might.
But I wonder if we go back in history to about 1978 in the name of Paul Weirich. And he was a fellow who worked for Goldwater in 64, and he was always looking for a way to capitalize on the conservatism of the evangelicals. And then in the election of 1978, there were three Democratic seats that were supposedly safe seats. And the weekend before the election, the parking lots of all the churches were leafleted with information saying that the Democrat was pro-abortion and you couldn't possibly vote for him. And they lost these safe seats. And so Weirich, you know, I believe, thought that he had finally found the issue. He tried pornography before, and that never captured that. But then all of a sudden, it was the abortion issue. And so abortion, racism and misogyny came together in 1978, and I think that somehow the roots of some of the divisiveness that exists in our country is traceable back to that period of time. So I'm wondering if you have any observations about that, or if I'm suggesting things that are not necessarily on your agenda.
No, I actually covered some of that. I think you're basically right on with a caveat or two. What happened then was Jimmy Carter was the most religious president we've had in our lifetime. I mean, he really was. He was devout. He was born again. He taught Sunday school. He would he was quite real. Ronald Reagan, you know, was a nice man, but he never went to church. And by 1980, the evangelical movement, starting from that 78, had cast aside one of their own, who they voted for in 76, and went with Reagan. That was the beginning of that. The issue was abortion. That was number two. The first issue was tax exemption for segregated schools. So it was race and abortion. And I think that did set in motion some of the stuff we see today. I think even more so was what Newt Gingrich did in the 90s when he said basically politics is about enemies. And but that 78 history, of you're right on.
Yeah, as far as it was a guy, back to the guy of Louisiana, was as influential as ever, a guy named Richard Viguerie, which was a kind of more common name. It's a German, it's a huge German influence in the river parishes. But a lot of, and Al's right, the thing that changed them was the religious exemption for these schools, and particularly these segregation academies. And the Republicans have had a long, and I would say till now, a very fruitful relationship with right-wing Protestantism and, to some extent, right-wing Catholicism, which those people I cannot stand. They're all over New Orleans. That's the hotbed of where these assholes come from. But that relationship, I believe, is going to come to a crashing end Tuesday night. That they allow themselves for temporary power to be taken over by a group that delivered them a lot of votes, delivered them a lot of money, delivered them a lot of seats, delivered them a lot of energy, a lot of door knockers, a lot of everything, but the bills come in due. That's what I really think is going to happen. And if what happens, what I think is going to happen, happens, I cannot wait to read, where does the Republican Party go from here?
Right.
Because I think it's going in a ditch for right now. It should be. So I don't mind maybe I'm being overly bullish, but I do think that they made a deal. I think Reagan, I can't endorse you, but you can endorse me, or whatever that kind of speech he gave. And he was very skilled. He opened his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Let me see here. Kind of amateur historian. I wonder why he did that. Okay, we know. But I do think that the bill's coming due.
I hate to tell an historical story with Doris Goodwin sitting here, but...
Do definitely.
I used to have... This was after he had left the Senate and left as 12 years as ambassador to Japan. I used to have lunch every year, sometimes twice, with Mike Mansfield for about 7 or 8 years. And he actually was a great storyteller. I mean, he was far more loquacious than you would see him. And he told the story that in 1965, when the Voting Rights Act was moving through the Senate, that Senator Vance Hartke from Indiana came to him and said, "I am sick and tired of you, Mr. Leader, giving Republicans all that credit." He said, "Everett Dirksen is on television every day, and you know we're the ones that are doing this." And Mansfield sits, and I said to him, "Senator, the Republican Party has been through a very hard time, a very difficult time with that last year's election, and I think that's not good for them, and it's not good for us, and it's not good for the country. And if we can help heal, I think it'll be really important for America." You couldn't imagine that story today. I mean, it would be unthinkable. It changed. And I think some of what happened in 78 and then Gingrich and certainly Trump took it to a new level. Can I go to my right here? Is there somebody over here?
Matt Stanley. James, Al, I love your show. I got 99 questions, but this one's for Doris.
Boy, you know how to go above our heads, don't you?
What if anything, did Caro get wrong about Johnson? And if nothing, what was his most useful insight from his approach?
I think the detail by which he is able to create scenes and make you feel part of every part of Johnson's life is truly masterful. I mean, I think at the beginning when he started, there was a sense of really going after Johnson for being a man who went after power. But once that power began to be used for the good of things, I think you could see that shift in the way he wrote about him. And finally, by the time he got to the Master of the Senate, and by the time he's now up to the Passage of Power, I think it's a miraculous group of books. I'm so glad that it may have been that the Johnson people worried about it at the start, but in the end, they're going to be very proud of those volumes, no question.
Do we go over to the left?
Yes.
Yes.
Name is Len Palillo. I am a retired teacher at college. I still teach one course, and I appreciate what you said earlier about people that teach. I really, really appreciate that. And James, I can say something to you. I have a little dome button. We have something in common. I see your LSU hat. I have a little golden dome button. So anyway, don't hold that against me. But the question I have for all three of you, and thank God you're bullish because it makes the anxiety go lower. But I'm just curious, as the votes come in, we know women are voting much more. As the vote come in, what do each one of you are looking for to see what trends? And also, how long do you think it's going to take before this is finalized?
I myself, when it comes in, I'm going to look at two Pennsylvania counties, Bucks and Northampton. But remember, if you're that interested, 2020 is a good benchmark because it was a close election.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So you can see where she's running, and those are just two counties that just come off the top. The other one I would look at is Hanover in North Carolina. I think it's Hanover is Wilmington.
Wilmington.
Obviously Gwinnett and Georgia, those kind of things. But I think Bucks and Northampton, if she is running decidedly ahead of Biden in 2020, I'm doing Amazon Prime, Brian Williams is doing election night, no ads, putting $1 zillion in it, it'd be really probably going to be the best coverage. And if I see a big vote in Bucks and Northampton, I say, look, I don't call anything for any network, but you can put this puppy to sleep. And I kind of think we might know early. And my two leading indicator of Bucks, which is right up to Delaware River from Philadelphia, and Northampton's like the Lehigh Valley, but those are two. She gets 55 in those two, we're off to the races.
Yeah, and North Carolina comes in early. And if she's winning North Carolina, game, set, match. I mean, she just is. And so we'll know something. Trump won't know it, or Trump won't admit it. He won't admit it Wednesday, won't admit it Thursday. Won't admit it December 6th, probably won't admit it January 6th. He will fight it all the way. They are better prepared than they were last time. I mean, can you imagine? They have better lawyers than Rudy Giuliani. But the other side, the Harris side, is much better prepared. They have some of the best lawyers in America. Seth Waxman, Don Verrilli, they have thousands of lawyers literally all over the country. So it'll be ugly for a while, even if it's not close. It won't matter. They're already saying stuff like there are these illegal hordes of migrants voting. Now let me just ask you a question. Just put yourself in the shoes of a undocumented migrant. You're probably a little bit nervous, right? I mean, with all this rhetoric. So you're going to go and you're going to show up at a polling booth and you're going to say, hey, my name is, I don't know, Manuel Gomez, and I want to vote. I mean, that's insane. Georgia did an audit. 8 million registered voters in Georgia. And you know how many illegal voters they found? 20. Almost all by mistake. I mean, 20 out of 8 million. I mean, Amazon would die for that kind of a record. So it's totally bogus. But they will do it, and he will insist they do it for a very simple reason. It delays the possibility of him going to the penitentiary.
I mean, I leave it to you guys to predict the future, but I think that I was reading today all the statements that the various people who lost the election made in with grace and class, except for Mr. Trump. And when Nixon wanted a recount maybe in 1960, because the election was very close, only 118,000 votes, and Eisenhower said to him, "Don't do it. Americans don't like a sore loser. Just accept these results and move on." Or I think about what Jimmy Carter said. He said, "I promised you I'd never tell you a lie. I can't say then. This does hurt. It hurts a lot. I'm disappointed. I've disappointed my followers." Every single one of them was able to be able to say, as Gore did when he made his concessions.
With Dick Goodwin helping.
Yes, which my husband helped him on. He said he brought it back to Stephen Douglas, who went in to see Lincoln and said, "Partisanship must give way now to patriotism." And he quoted Stephen Douglas, and he said, "I now am doing that, and I wish him the best stewardship of the country. I don't agree with the decision, but it's the rule of law." And I think we've got to remember that peaceful transition of power, George Washington would be rolling over in his grave for having given it up after two terms, for having not taken over as general, as the King of England said, you know, if he really did that, if he gave it up, he must be the greatest man in the world, as he said in Hamilton. So I think we've got to remember that that's what we have to expect, and it may take a while, but that peaceful transition will bear out this time, if it's truly so. The only thing I'd like to say about the Republican Party, which we're mentioning before, is I think there's hope in the fact that the Whig Party, which was the party of Abraham Lincoln, it collapsed as a result of the slavery issue, and a new party was formed, and that was the Republican Party, the great part of the Republican Party. So we've got to hope that somehow we need bipartisanship in this country eventually. We need a good opposition in the parties. And it was a much better thing when Dirksen was being given credit for the Civil Rights Act. Lyndon Johnson was the one that told him, sleep with him, drink with him, eat with him, because he needed the 22 Republicans to join the 44 Democrats to break the filibuster and get the Civil Rights Bill through. He finally says to Everett Dirksen as his closing argument, "I'll give you anything you want, you know, this transcendent, it didn't matter, nothing was transparent then. You want me to come to Peoria, Springfield, I'll come. You want to have a dam, a public works project, you got it." Then he finally says to him, "Everett, if you come with me on this bill and you bring your Republicans along, 200 years from now, school children will know only two names, Abraham Lincoln and Everett Dirksen." Little wonder that he went along, but I think we got to hope that a new party will emerge from this, because you need those two parties to be fighting each other.
Thank you. You guys are the best.
I think we have time for two more questions at least, so let me go to the right first. And
thank you. Hi, my name is Catherine Dahl, and my question for you, Doris, is, so my husband and I, we chose to name our firstborn after Teddy Roosevelt, not Everett Dirksen. And we actually, at the time, received some opposition, mostly from my mother. And we have our reasons why we chose him as the namesake, but I'm curious what you would tell my 5-year-old son why it's an honor to be named after Teddy Roosevelt.
Oh, I absolutely would. I mean, I think Teddy Roosevelt brought the progressive tradition to the Republican Party. It was already there in the settlement houses and in the social gospel. But he was able to pass a series of laws that actually were able to soften the Industrial Revolution, which had shaken up the economy, much like globalization and the tech revolution today. And he was able to get big business and Standard Oil under a lawsuit. He was able to, you know, have minimum wage and maximum hours, working about workers' rights. And I think that he brought America, the government, into, it was much bigger in the New Deal, but he brought government into being a protector of working people and of people who needed help. And I think he can be very proud of him. And just remember, too, I was just speaking in a fifth grade class the other day, because I have this other book out about 4 kids becoming president, the leadership journey, hoping that young people can look at my 4 guys and watch them as their leaders evolving into the leadership, and then maybe think maybe I could become one of them. But I asked the kids, how many of you know where the teddy bear came from? And lots of them raised their hand and knew that it was Teddy Roosevelt, after which the teddy bear was named. So for a 5-year-old, that would be very proud to know that this incredible toy, the most popular toy of all time, they thought he was should be honored. So I think that your son can be honored too, and tell your mother that.
Thank you.
I'll add one thing. He also, that, I think you could say that Teddy is a more fun name than Everett.
So I'll add, I did an event at Barclays Bank, and I met Ted Roosevelt, who looks just like a banker. He's the great, 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 great grandson of Teddy Roosevelt. His name is Ted Roosevelt, but living guy. And he said, James, I've been a Republican all my life. There's no way that I'm voting for Donald Trump. So there you go. Teddy Roosevelt lives with us today. His great, 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 great grandson. And he didn't tell me off the record. He didn't say, don't say anything. And the guy looks just like you would think a banker looks, okay? He's impeccably dressed and everything. He don't like Trump.
Well, George W. Bush hasn't said anything, but his daughter is in Pennsylvania right now canvassing for Kamala Harris.
Good evening. I'm John Adams. Thanks for being here.
Oh, wow.
Good Boston.
You were,
Thank you for coming.
Wait a minute. Let's give. He was the first person to begin the orderly transfer of power, even though he really probably got screwed in that election. So go ahead, Mr. President.
Well, we know we've been dealing with some very tight polls, but the tightest poll we're dealing with tonight is whether James was coming with LSU or the Marine Corps. And LSU went out on that. Hey. The real issue that we've been dealing with is voting, election integrity. There's a lot around on that. You mentioned Doris Johnson, the Voting Rights Act. My question is, can you explain what happened with Shelby? Can you explain whether there's anything to be done about Shelby? And is there any possibility that the Supreme Court has a scintilla of regret about what has happened with the Voting Rights Act?
Thank you. I yield to James on this.
Oh, God. So, the Shelby thing just, like, kicked me in the stomach. And growing up in the South, never thought about voting. You got out of bed, you voted, you didn't vote. 18-year-old at some point got right to vote. Black people have an entirely different relationship with voting than white people. We just never think about that we're not going to vote. And it might be a little rigmarole here, but it's just nothing that it's not without. So when, I'll tell you the story, Dorothy, Andy Young and Martin Luther King, Young tells a story, they were flying back from Oslo, and King tells Andy, go tell the pilot I want to stop at Dulles and go see Johnson. So they stop at Dulles, they're on the way back to Atlanta, and Johnson keeps him waiting on him for 6 hours out there because he's just an asshole. And so they go in.
But a good asshole.
Yeah, a good one. But, you know, and King goes in and said, Mr. President, we appreciate all your work on civil rights, but we got to have voting rights. And Johnson, I think, correctly said, Martin, I don't have any gas left in the tank. I'm twisting every arm I can. I got all my power is used up to get civil rights passed. And I just can't do it. I don't have it. So they go back and they get on a plane, and King says, the president needs more power. Let's go get him some.
Exactly.
Okay? That's how Selma came about. You have these modern people that if you're not pure, so if you go in and they say, look, I just don't have the gas in the tank to do this, they would boycott you. They would vote against you. They'd start protests. And the way that you help people is give them power. Okay? Power, political power is where this comes from. And King was a visionary enough as opposed to saying, going out and attacking him, he said, let's get him some more power.
This is so great. This is a really important thing because, in fact, what he did say in that meeting, too, he said, why don't you just find some place down there where the voting rights are being so blatantly abused, and then people, the guy in the tractor, will understand that this is what we have to do. And you're right, it was going to be dependent on the civil rights movement. That's how change always takes place in the country, and that's what we have to know now. Any kind of movement towards social justice, it happens from the ground up. When Lincoln was called a liberator, he said, don't call me a liberator. It was the anti-slavery movement and the Union soldiers that did it all. It was the progressive movement at the turn of the century, as I said before, that was already in the social gospel, in the settlement house movement that made the, what Teddy Roosevelt did possible. And of course, it was the civil rights movement that made everything possible. The bravery and the courage of the civil rights movement was what brought about the response to Bull Connor, that brought about the firing of the conscience after Selma. And then it was the women's movement and the gay rights movement. So whatever happens in this election, the most important thing is that we citizens have to be active. Again, it's up to us to heal the country or to build the country. And you're right, that's right.
Over here.
Hi, thank you for being here tonight. My name's Christian. I'm in a master's program for applied politics at Suffolk University, and we read a book about where have all the Democrats gone, and they identify a great divide, which means like between the educated and non-educated. So more specifically with the American electorate, I'm curious about what shifts you might project in 2024 that we may have not seen since 1996 Bill Clinton's triangulation concept when he moved more left voters to the moderate stage. And I wonder what shifts that you'll project for 2024. Thank you.
So I'll take this first. I really want to answer the question. To be a Democrat is first and foremost to be part of a coalition. And if you're totally comfortable, you're not in a coalition. Okay, you're just not. You're in an ideological cult, or you're in a personality cult, which is the Republicans now. We Democrats don't want to be that. And a coalition shifts, it changes. Roosevelt had a coalition. Lincoln said the coalition above everything. And political people instinctively understand coalitions. And the party has to adjust. So we become more educated. There's no doubt about that. And some people, you know, when I worked in New Jersey in 1988, we lost New Jersey by 8 to Bush, and we won the Senate race by 8. We carried West Virginia, and we lost California. All right? That's how coalitions change. That's really, really important to keep in mind, because you're having to hold all this together. Now, one of my favorite things is, and I see this all the time, these are 5 things the Democratic Party needs to do to fix itself. This is what's wrong with Democrats. Well, I got news for you, son of a bitch. We ain't lost an election in 2 years. What do we need fixing? The purpose of a political party is actually to win elections. That's why we exist. And that's why our coalition is an evolving, adjustable thing. It's not was not the same coalition that Lyndon Johnson had. It's not the same coalition that Jimmy Carter had or we had in 92. It is, when you look at American politics, you particularly the Democratic Party, you have to think of it as a kind of living, growing, metamorphosed thing. It's not always the same. I don't know, Doris, if that makes sense.
Oh,
of what?
Completely makes sense. Keep going.
Okay, no, I just say, and I tell people, if you're in a coalition and you're comfortable, you're not in a coalition. And for this one moment, Dick Cheney and AOC are in the same coalition. I know it's not going to stick. All right? I know it's not going to stick. But, and that's what I love about politics. It's not stationary. Wow. It actually lives. It grows, it progresses, it meanders. It's like the, you know, I grew up on the Mississippi River, and the river, it actually at Carville, it kind of runs north, believe it or not. But the river is always seeking the Gulf, all right? It may meander, it may change, but it has a goal in mind. And when I think of the Democratic Party, there's a goal in mind. Let's get out in the Gulf. Let's get to the end of this thing, and let's win it.
Wow, that is poetry. That is poetry. Wow.
You know, I had a dear friend that James knew named Alan Barron. And Alan Barron said, you're in trouble. You're in real trouble if your coalition is really happy. It's not going to last. And you're in real trouble if your coalition is really unhappy. And finding that delicate balance is what politics is all about. And I think that's why James is right. The coalition that exists for this election isn't going to last. But how she and the other Democrats. They're very lucky to have incredibly talented leaders in the Hill. Nancy Pelosi was the greatest speaker in our lifetime. Maybe the greatest. With all due apologies to Henry Clay and others, maybe the greatest speaker in the history of the Republic.
Yeah.
And incredibly, she has a successor. It can't be Nancy Pelosi, because nobody can at first, but in Hakeem Jeffries, who is a worthy successor. So that'll matter a lot. You know, we talked a lot today about the presidential race, and Lord knows that's the most important. But let's not forget that if Harris wins, she needs a Democratic House for sure, and it's going to be tougher, but maybe a Democratic Senate. But they have some really talented leaders up there, and that will help get through these difficult transitions. We have time for one or two more. I went to my right last time, didn't I? I'm always uncomfortable going over there. It's nothing personal. Here we go.
Good evening. Thank you for being here. Doris, you might remember in 1984, Dick gave an intellectual autobiography at Tufts University. And at that moment, he inspired a young man who then became an ambassador, holding Holbrook's hand in the ambulance as he expired, and he's just been part of a transition team vetting the vice presidential candidates for Harris. So I want to, it's a poignant memory for me.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm glad to know that. That's pretty important.
Yeah. And James, I want to thank you for supporting Patrick Schmidt, my student a few years
ago. Oh, wow, yeah, in Kansas, yeah.
Yeah, and he's running again.
Yeah, he is. He's run for the state Senate.
Yeah, so thank you very much for that support, and Al Franken and others. I'm asking a question about the civil-military relationship in our country. I'm concerned about what happens in the aftermath of this election. I cannot fathom why January 6th wasn't the Rubicon. I can't understand the kinds of language that's being said about Milley. I can't understand. I'm remembering Trump, you know, threatening us with his motorcycle gangs and the Hell's Angels years ago. Steve Simon's written wonderful stuff about the threat of a civil war. We have an Insurrection Act on our books. What do you, either of you, consider the threat in the immediate aftermath of Tuesday?
James, I need your fiery language right now.
Yeah, well, okay, let's start. Trump won in 2016 on kind of a distributional fluke, to be honest with you, but he won. He lost in 18. He lost in 20. They lost in 2022. They are losing. They're going to lose Tuesday. All right? They are having a... Sometimes a Democrat has to sit back and say, because what I know is being part of this coalition, we have the most nervous, glass half full people I've ever seen in my life. All right? And I think that Tuesday night is going to be the finest hour the United States has had in a long time. I really do.
Good pleasure.
And I couldn't allow myself, you know, at the end of the whole thing, and Doris's history and Al and all of us, at the end of the day, we like the United States, okay? We just do. We just feel very passionate about it. And, you know, you hear people say, shit, I trust the American people and the wisdom and the goodness of the American people. And I think the American people will come through for us. Wow. I really do.
I think that's a wonderful way to end, and I will say this is the finest audience I've ever seen. And how many of you feel better than you did 2 hours ago? So just keep feeling that way until Tuesday night, okay? Hey, thank you very much.
Hooray.
You're a wonderful audience.